without much further ado, I will introduce Diane Fields. Diane is a long-term socialist here in Sydney. She was a radical in her teenage days in the anti-war movement. Somebody I really look up to, has a wealth of activist experience, and she's going to be introducing the topic of third world poverty today. We'll be leaving discussion to the end of Diane's talk, but people should consider what they want to say in the discussion. If you've got some thoughts, then jot them down, whether that be a question, a disagreement, or just a contribution you'd like to chip in. So, yeah, please welcome Diane.
Well, this is one of those talks that could be very short. Why is the third world so poor? Capitalism. Sit down. Or very, very long. I've tried to, you know, make it not too long. But in the spirit of very short, the first thing I want to say is, at the moment, according to the most recent figures from Oxfam, which are a charity concerned with global poverty, 42 billionaires have as much wealth as the bottom 3.7 billion people on the planet. That is 42 billionaires versus half of humanity. So that's a kind of picture of income distribution, inequality, poverty, and so on. But it's important then to go on to say this poverty is not distributed evenly between countries. And therefore we have the periodic focus on things like Live Aid, Make Poverty History, Oxfam itself, and other charities. I want to begin with a kind of a common sense narrative about third world poverty, and that's the imperialist narrative about the third world. I'm going to use the third world as a terminology, even though there's all sorts of other terminologies that's sort of out of date and so on. People know what I mean. Because a lot of the other terminology I find offensive. Developing world, it implies that somehow there's this nice, neat process going on. I hate that one. So we'll stick with third world. And what's the imperialist narrative? Well, basically, these countries are eternal basket cases requiring intervention from the benevolent West to end their poverty, which is in fact due to their own incapacity. It's a classic piece of victim blaming. Clark Gascoigne, who works for a body called Global Financial Integrity, which kind of examines what's going on in terms of global inequality, comments, in development circles, we talk a lot about how much aid is going to Africa, and there's this feeling amongst some in the West that after we've been giving this money for decades, it's Africa's fault if the continent's countries still haven't developed. And that's a pretty good summary, I think, of that imperialist narrative. But as I want to go on in the rest of the talk to explain, this version is a vastly distorted account that ignores or erases the destructive role played by foreign multinational corporations, imperialist governments, and so on. That is, it ignores the logic of international capitalism and its competition. It ignores the whole history of that colonial competition that preceded modern imperialism and so on, and the role of all of that in keeping the third world poor. But the dominant narrative of whose fault it is, you know, it gets a pretty good outing. President Barack Obama, for example, in July 2009, that is right in the midst of the global financial crisis, visited Accra in Ghana, and he insisted that African nations' own mismanagement, these are quotes, mismanagement and lack of democracy, quote, was to blame for their economic and social problems. He actually used the phrase, just to make it clear to them, the West is not responsible. The truth, however, is quite different. US policymakers actually view economic crisis as an opportunity to rebuild the global economy at the expense of ordinary people. And they, at the expense of ordinary people in both the third world and in the imperialist heartlands as well. Remember what happened when the global financial crisis broke out. The IMF directed industrialised nations to enact stimulus plans and bank bailouts, not for us, for the rich. Africa and other third world countries were compelled to accept spending cuts and other harsh conditions for loans, forcing low-income countries to prioritise debt repayment over such unnecessary things as social services, food, that sort of stuff. So rather than being the fault of these ubiquitous Africans, decades of International Monetary Fund and World Bank loans and structural adjustment policies have placed an economic stranglehold on third world economies. And across the world, this has resulted in decimated social programs, a debt crisis, and low wages, which are endemic across the third world. And these things are not just accidents or unfortunate, you know, like bad weather or something like that. Not that that's an accident these days. They are conditions favourable for US and other imperialist investment, not for most people who live in the third world. There are some people in the third world who do well out of them, a tiny 1%, and I'll mention them again later. So there's a long-term picture that emerges here. Rather than imperialist intervention helping the third world, we have instead shocking levels of inequality, oppression, poverty. And in fact, these things are no less prevalent today than they have been since the end of colonialism. In fact, the South African Marxist Patrick Bond, for example, has argued that Africans across sub-Saharan Africa are poorer today than they were at independence from the colonial powers. Such a success. So today, even sharper unevenness exists not only between Africa and the West, but also, importantly, I said I'd come back to those people that did well in the third world, there is more unevenness within African nations themselves. Because every country has its capitalists, and so because these are capitalist countries, they are divided between the ruling class and the mass of ordinary people. One example, in Nigeria, a major source of oil, 80% of the nation's oil wealth is concentrated in the hands of 1% of the Nigerian population. A figure that is probably common to all of you who think back to the Occupy Wall Street days of 2011, that phrase, the 1%, to talk about capitalists, actually, it's exactly right when you look at the Nigerian oil industry. And of course, I've talked a lot about countries in Africa, and I'm going to continue to do so, because if there is an image, in fact, the image that we used in advertising this talk is, of course, an image of Africa. Because that image of, I mean, those of you who are younger probably haven't seen as much of this as I have, but the sort of image of starving African children in some unknown, unnamed country and so on that we should feel sorry for really does sort of sum up a lot of the picture of third world poverty. But it would be a mistake to think that Africa is somehow the heartland of this. Let's look, because we are in the Australian imperialist economy, let's look at the Asia Pacific, where Australia is the dominant imperialist power. Now, despite Julie Bishop, do we remember her, saying in July, seems so long ago now, that, quote, we would like the Pacific to see Australia as providing them with the kind of support that maintains their sovereignty, maintains their economic stability, and doesn't become an unsustainable debt burden. Actually, in terms of Australia's real relationship with the Asia Pacific, the opposite of all that is the case. Look at Papua New Guinea, for example. Australia is the dominant foreign economic player. Papua New Guinea didn't even get independence until 1975. $18 billion of Australian capital was invested there in 2016, more than from any other country. And it did not come without strings attached. Australian aid, so-called, actually is not aid, but it's aid to Australian capitalism and Australian imperialism, not aid to the people of Papua New Guinea. And Australia's economic power buys plenty of influence. Since 2004, Australian officials have been embedded in key positions in Papua New Guinea's public service, its police and its military. Oh, but they let them elect their government. So more than 40% of Australian aid goes to enforcing what our rulers call good governance. That is more than to health and education combined. And good governance is a diplomatic code for imposing Australia's preferred neoliberal model of economic management and so on, delivered by private sector consultants selected and managed by Australia in the interests not of the people of Papua New Guinea, but in the interests of profit maximisation and political stability that they regard as necessary in order to make those profits. And a PNG is just one example. Similar things could be said about Australia's role in the Solomons, and I think the outstanding example in terms of why is the third world so poor is Timor-Leste. Australia has had a long military and economic intervention into what is one of the poorest countries in the world. And has the rising tide lifted all boats? Has Australia helped Timor-Leste get out of that poverty? No, Australia has made deliberate efforts to increase that poverty, and the most obvious thing is stealing their oil. And so these are the interests of Australian imperialism, not poverty eradication, just as is the case throughout the rest of the Third World. So in other words, it's quite a different story to the common sense of the rich nations of the OECD giving generously of their wealth to the poorer nations to help them eradicate poverty and push them up the development ladder. There's one more argument I want to deal with in terms of the way that bullshit is talked about the poverty of the Third World, and that's the one that seems more reasonable. Oh yes, during colonialism, Western powers may unfortunately have enriched themselves by extracting resources and slave labour from their colonies, but that's all in the past. These days, they give more than $125 billion each year to the Third World, so they're making up for all that colonial horror. And this argument's one that's actually widely propagated by sections of the aid industry and certainly by the governments of the rich world. And it's very useful because one of the key things in justifying what happens to the Third World is, of course, racism. And so basically all of these right-wing arguments, it's all their own fault, they're kind of shiftless, there's something built into the nature of, you know, insert name of country here, Third World society. Those arguments are actually very useful for stoking racism at home to find another scapegoat for austerity policies here. So, oh, well, the reason that we have to cut hospitals, education, whatever, is because we're giving all the money to, you know, benighted third world countries. Bullshit. Okay. I mentioned before the Global Financial Integrity Organisation as a kind of a watchdog, if you like, of what's really going on with aid. They've done a very interesting survey looking at adding up all the financial resources that get transferred between rich countries and poor countries each year. And they looked at it pretty broadly. They didn't just look at aid and foreign investment and trade flows. They also looked at transfers such as debt, workers' remittances and unrecorded capital flight. And they found a nice total. In 2012, which is the last year that I was able to find their recorded data, developing countries received a total of $1.3 trillion from the West. How generous. That included all aid, investment and income from abroad going into the Third World. But the same year, some $3.3 trillion flowed out of them to the West. And when I say flowed out into the West, there's an important distinction to make here. Not to the West in the abstract. None of it came to you and me or to any working class person, but to Western capitalists. And there's a range of ways in which we can see this: repayments on debts, basically a big cash transfer to the major banks of the world economy. Another big contributor is the income that foreign capitalists make on their investments in developing countries, and then repatriate back to their bank accounts. Again, once again, not to Western working class people whose wages, jobs and working conditions they are simultaneously undermining, but to their own class, to the capitalist class. I mean, we could go through the list forever. I'll just add one more, which is that corporations, foreign and domestic alike in the Third World, spirit money out of developing countries. And, of course, it's not only out of developing countries. One in three, as we heard at the opening night session last night, one in three corporations in Australia pay no tax. But they take whatever money they can extract and put it directly into tax havens and secret jurisdictions like the Cayman Islands, where they pay no tax. So all of this leads us to a question of, which hopefully the hints are already there, of who benefits. Now, all of this, I think, is worth establishing because there's plenty of theft from the developing world. So one reason we say, why is the developing world, why is the third world so poor, is actually this question of theft. Theft in the form of the normal operation of capitalist accumulation. Plenty of theft from the developing world, not because money is being siphoned into the pockets of workers in countries like Australia, but because it's being siphoned into the pockets and bank accounts of those who really run this world. I want to talk now about a bit of history. Some of the origins of third world poverty, and I'm going to focus on the countries of Africa just because the world is far too big to look at all of them. The forces underlying African poverty are far from reducible to problems of corruption and governance, as Barack Obama would have it. Instead, they're rooted in historic relationships of exploitation within the broader capitalist system. I think there's three kind of main periods to look at. Firstly, the thwarting of industrial development in the conditions created by colonialism. Secondly, the national development models attempted by African ruling classes, capitalists, all of them, I will say, after independence during the period of the Cold War. And thirdly, the narrowing of those aspirations and horizons into single commodity export economies and IMF and World Bank imposed austerity programs. The American socialist Lee Wengraff, in a wonderful article called Legacies of Colonialism in Africa, says this: these three things have all combined to produce debt crises, collapses of infrastructure, poverty, lack of access to healthcare, high rates of HIV/AIDS, low wages, low literacy rates, an explosion of urban slums, and a host of other poor grades on human development indicators. And I think that's a picture of the kind of perfect storm that world capitalism has created for whole swathes of the world. Essentially, imperialist powers and global financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank are to blame for both the historic and the contemporary inequality on the planet. Third world poverty is not simply a fact of nature, but is something that has been deliberately manufactured through the historical processes of exploitation and neoliberalism, built upon and impacted by the legacies of the preceding colonialism and underdevelopment that came out of it. So in other words, Western foreign policy towards Africa, towards elsewhere in the third world, does not merely produce poverty and inequality as an accidental byproduct, but rather third world debt, structural adjustment, privatisation and trade liberalisation are intentional strategies of competitive profit maximisation and nothing else. And all of this has been exacerbated by the crisis of profitability since the mid-1970s, all of which has been driven not by a desire to somehow be nasty and bully small nations or weaker nations, but driven instead by what is central to understanding imperialism, what drives them to continuously secure access to markets, investment opportunities, resources and political influence is the fact that they're in competition with their imperialist rivals. The competition between the major powers really is the driving force of all of this, even though it's played out on the smaller and less developed powers. Okay, a few more details. I'm going to go back to a little bit more on the legacies of colonialism. The weaknesses of the post-colonial independent nations of areas of the world such as Africa, those weaknesses are a result of the colonialism. It left a political heritage of weak states. Why did the colonial powers want weak states? Because they wanted to dominate them. With limited control over territory, regimes, again set up by the colonial powers, that relied on ethnic divisions, centralised authority and patronage systems inherited from colonial rule. The economic systems were anchored to a narrow export base with a weak industrial sector and weak rates of growth. And these states therefore inherited an underdeveloped infrastructure that was geared towards exports, lacking in capital, and skewed towards supplying unfinished goods to the advanced countries. one example. In 1967, pretty much the end of the process of decolonisation of what had been the former colonial empires throughout Africa. In 1967, a full 90% of Africa's exports comprised raw materials such as oil, copper, cotton, coffee and cocoa. Again, not because Africans wanted these things. They couldn't eat most of them, for example. And even the ones that were edible were not edible by them. But because that is the way in which their economies had been structured into the world imperialist system. And then when colonialism ended, the weak economic and political footing of the new African states on this basis laid by colonialism left them vulnerable to interference from the West. So when independence was won, the United States, or in some cases, it's the Cold War era, in some cases the USSR, found an opening in the new decolonised states to replace the influence of these countries' former colonial masters. The former colonial powers didn't give up entirely. They might have lost their kind of political ownership, but they maintained in general a military presence in their former colonies, while the US became increasingly interested in the 1960s in establishing outposts of their own, crucially making aid and loans contingent on that military presence, just to make sure. And when they couldn't get their way by these kind of more peaceful economic means, although they weren't really peaceful when you think what they meant for the consequences of people's lives, when they couldn't get their way, then of course they could remove leaders they didn't like by assassinating, like they did with Patrice Lumumba of the Congo in 1961. Easy. This economic and military domination by the major imperialist powers, especially the United States, compelled an accommodation with foreign capital and imperialist states on the part of all of the post-colonial states. In other words, there was nothing benevolent in this. It was all about where maximum profit could be made. It's the reason why very little, or a very small proportion, of American foreign direct investment in this period, in the kind of period of the decolonisation of Africa of the 60s and into the 70s, very little of US foreign direct investment was in Africa. And actually one third of that which was in Africa was all in apartheid South Africa. That is, they just decided, not any desire to help out, but where can we make profits? And if we can't make profits, well, they can rot. On top of this, just to make it more difficult, attempts at autonomous national capitalist development also faltered soon after independence as a result largely of the pre-existing poverty, that is, the size and scale of capital resources that needed to be marshalled both to develop and to protect fledgling industries were prohibitively high given the state of world capitalism with which these new states had to compete. And more, they were being sidelined in any case. The pattern of international investment and trade changed quite dramatically in the period of the post-war boom. Before the war, around 40% of world trade was in primary products, agricultural products, fuel and other raw materials. By the end of the long boom, this figure had fallen by a half, and international trade became much less a matter of exchange between primary producers on one hand and manufacturers on the other, and much more a question of trade in manufacturers between relatively industrialised nations. So one of the reasons for the sidelining of a whole range of the third world was that the developed world decided they didn't need their products anymore. Okay, so which brings us to the neoliberal era, our present era. The period from the mid-1970s crisis to the present, marked by a host of economic policies aimed at breaking down barriers to trade and to investment by the West, again with the same dynamic. You may see there's a certain pattern emerging here. To facilitate the political and social conditions most favourable for capital accumulation and profit maximisation across the globe. And these are the interests in which conditions such as compliant local regimes, low wages, weak or preferably no unions, overall high levels of labour exploitation, weak regulatory environments, none of those nasty environmental safeguards, for example, and so on, have been enforced. It's absolutely not about development. And today, we see a new phenomenon, the shift of production jobs to low-wage nations. But it's based, once again, primarily on one criterion, where the wage differentials in prospective third world workers and the overhead regulatory costs permit unit costs to be reduced and profits maximised compared to investment elsewhere. This is the explanation for decades of very little investment in the third world. They had cheap labour, but the lack of infrastructure and political instability meant that they weren't guaranteeing the profits that the bosses wanted. And now they've decided that all bets are off, that they can actually make money out of investing in these low-wage economy. But what is the effect of this in the West? Well, it's worth saying this has also had a negative effect on workers in the West. This whole process has hollowed out much of the industrial working class in advanced economies. These skills can now be purchased in the international market on the cheap. But the same logic that produces third world poverty is also the logic that throws Western workers on the scrap heap. And it helps to make it clear once again who benefits from this competitive race to the bottom driven by the search for profits. So, to conclude, we can make poverty history as that organisation, remember Bob Geldof and Bono, yes, so delightful. I've got a bit more to say about them. We can make poverty history, though. It's a good phrase, make poverty history. Whereas capitalism's phrase is really make poverty. So we can make poverty history, but not if we accept the logic of capitalism, where profit trumps human need every time. For example, I made a quick list. A few things you could do. Drop all the debt. Stop imposing neoliberal austerity policies. Stop multinationals ripping profits out of the third world. End military occupations of a country like Afghanistan. Use the hundreds of billions spent on arms to really deal with the causes of poverty. That's just a quick list. There's tons of other things. But, of course, what's the barrier? Doing this would run up against the interests of powerful banks and corporations that benefit hugely from the existing poverty, not to mention governments throughout the world. So we can have no faith in the optimistic version outlined by the World Bank in April 2013. This is an actual quote. I'm not making this up. It was an article headed, World Bank Sets Goal of Eliminating Extreme Poverty by 2030. But I actually went and found the recording on YouTube of these assholes saying it. And this is what they said. We have set an expiration date. With commitment, cooperation and the vision of leaders from around the world, we have great faith that we can make it happen. Well, I don't know about you, but that doesn't fill me with any confidence whatsoever, especially when in the same article it then mentions, following the meetings, world finance leaders issued a sombre assessment of the global economy, saying the recovery remains uneven with growth and jobs in short supply. So no prizes of those two things, eliminate extreme poverty by 2030 and the world economy's fucked. No prizes for guessing which will predominate. And so our political opposition, I think, to the obvious features of imperialism, to militarism, to militaristic interventions, whether under the rubric of humanitarianism or whatever, has to be matched by an equal hostility to the oppressive reality of what constitutes peaceful global trade and aid under capitalism. It's the same system and it operates on the same logic. But that also, because it's all been a bit negative so far, I want to end with something a little bit more positive. It also means knowing which side you're on, because there are sides. Post-colonial economic development has resulted in combined and uneven development that has concentrated industrial growth in the third world, or what used to be the third world, in key centres. Think about Nigeria or South Africa compared to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. other regions have been left far behind. And that means the development of the hope for the future, the development of a working class. Class polarisation has expressed itself most sharply in these centres, with enthusiastic support for market-based neoliberal reform by the local ruling class on the one hand and working class resistance on the other. And so knowing which side you're on matters, which brings me back to Bono and Geldof. In 2005, they attached themselves to the Make Poverty History campaign. Lucky them. And what their role in it was to attempt to court sections of the existing political and economic establishment. They seemed to believe that if they were nice to government ministers, the heads of certain multinational corporations, and some people associated with the IMF and World Bank, those people would turn their fine words about development and so on into caring and doing something about the plight of the poor. And one real low point, and it's always Bono that's a low point. Bono even wrote a laudatory introduction to the new Penguin paperback, The End of Poverty. The book was written by a guy called Jeffrey Sachs. Sachs was head at that point of the UN's Millennium Project, and his qualifications for being head of the UN's Millennium Project lay in a long history of advising Latin American governments, from Bolivia to Brazil to Argentina to pre-Chavez Venezuela, advising those Latin American governments how to impose neoliberal policies. He also had previously helped the Polish and Russian governments to do the same, imposing neoliberal policies after the fall of Stalinism. And Jeffrey Sachs makes no apologies for such actions in the book, which is, you know, makes it just even worse that Bono wrote the introduction to it. In fact, what Sachs has to say is about a really tragic thing that happened when he was helping these people of Latin America. He said it was very sad that there'd been an uprising of Bolivia's workers and peasants which had driven his former friend, the president, Connie Sanchez de Lozada, from office in 2003. Well, which side are you on? I think the common interest of working class people around the world against our profit-hungry rulers are combined with the potential power, and it is only a potential at the moment, but we can see it in things like that that working class and poor uprising in Bolivia in 2003 that went on for several years against all of the ways in which capitalism embeds poverty, reinforces poverty, and so on. The potential power of working class people to overthrow that system. And so it means we do need to take sides. We need to support the working class, the poor of the third world, when they rise up against those who have made them poor, the international capitalist class and the governments and international institutions that serve them. That's what side we need to be on. We need to be organised. We need to be political. We need to understand who our enemies are and who our friends are, and then we need to act.